space where we explore how data, digital innovation, and AI are reshaping the rare diseases landscape. I'm your host today, and we are just about diving into a topic that sits at the core of so many patient journeys: genetics. For many families, genetics feels abstract or even overwhelming, but once we break it down, it becomes a powerful tool. And today, we are going to understand why. And I couldn't wish for a better guest to discuss this topic today. Thank you very much, Célia Azevedo-Soares, for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
To kick us off, Célia, let's start with the basics. And we often hear terms like genes and chromosomes, but in your opinion, why do they matter so much, especially in the rare diseases space? And could you also give us a quick overview of how genetics has evolved over time?
So I believe when we talk about genes and chromosomes, we are talking about like complex and hard words for very simple concepts, because we all have this idea that we have something in common with our ancestors. We notice we have something similar with our parents, and maybe there is something that is driven these features and that make us, you know, have some sameness with our ancestors. So people knew there was something that was making us look like our ancestors, but we didn't know exactly what. So we had this notion for many years until someone decided to study some peas, you know, the vegetable. And that was Mendel. And studying peas, he was able to understand some rules of inheritance. And that's how it all started. And that's how we move our knowledge to understand that genes existed. These genes are, they are something that we know exactly what they were that shape how our body is made. So in a simple terms, genes are just instructions that make our body look like it is. It's not like our lettering system that is quite complex. Genes are more simple. We have many letters in our alphabet. Well, genes, they only have four letters. And with four simple letters, they make the instructions to build our body. So at the end, genes are just that, simple instructions that say what is the color of our eyes, how many fingers do we have. So it's something very simple with that for many, maybe my millennia, we suspected that was something like this that was making us as we are. And if you talk about chromosomes, usually I just say they are like just a shelf, you know, some place where we storage our instructions to make our body. So these are terms that look complex, but at the end they're quite simple if we just remember that we kind of already knew they existed for millennia. We suspected something was making our body as it is, and we suspected that it was inherited because we have so many common features with our parents, siblings, and other family members.
Yeah, when you describe it, or in the way you describe it, it makes it truly sound simple. But indeed, it just manages so many different parts of our human, or ourselves as human beings. But now that we kind of grounded ourselves in the basics, I'm curious as well to understand how much it is known in Portugal, in Europe even. So when we look at Portugal and maybe abroad, how would you describe our overall genetics literacy, not just as a society, but also within the healthcare professionals and, again, the rare disease communities?
That's a very good question. And my most honest answer is we have no idea. We don't have data on that. So if you don't have data, we don't know. So we don't know what is the Portuguese situation in terms of literacy of healthcare professionals. We have data from other countries in Europe, and we know that in certain areas, less than 20% of physicians feel comfortable talking or explaining genetic tests. So even in Europe, where we are actually studying this, we are working on this, and there are multiple initiatives to promote genetics literacy in the healthcare community. Even in in Europe, like less than one in five physicians feel comfortable with these concepts. And if you talk in Portugal, I'm not sure if we are in a better or worse situation because if we have never studied, we don't know. But I suspect maybe less than 20%.
Right, which is a mark that, or a number that should be kept in our minds, right? When we look into the rare diseases, knowing that more than 72% is coming from genetics origin, it sounds like it is something important to know. And Sally, thank you very much for sharing
And
that insights.
we also need to look at other numbers. We suspect that one in what one in 12 people have a rare disease. I believe that those are the most recent statistics. So I don't know, but I see more than 12 patients a day in my clinic. But I work in rare disease, so for me, obviously, it's easier to see more of those patients. But if you're talking about emergency room, if you're talking a family physician, there is a quite a higher chance they are seeing a patient with rare disease on their daily basis, but they have no idea, and there is a very high probability that that patient will have a disease related with genetics, and the people who are seeing that patient, that specific person with a very specific disease, they might not have the appropriate literacy to deal with the com well, with this apparent complexity of rare disease. Because at the end, they are not that complex. The main issues is having access to the proper information and to, you know, make things less complicated that they than they seem to be.
To simplifying those complex topics without losing the scientific nature of them.
Yeah, and know where to look for the proper information, and so you can give the best care for people. Because information for some of the rare diseases is out there, not for all. If you're talking about the ultra rare field, that's another field in the rare disease field. Maybe there is less information, but if you're talking about some more common rare disease, there is plenty of information, and sometimes you just need to guide people to that information so they can provide the best care for people.
And Sally, another theme, another topic, which is sometimes not as well known, is this term of natural history of a disease. What does it actually mean? And why is it so important for research, diagnosis, and the way we actually develop the treatments?
Well, it's very basic. If you look, what it really means, it just means get to know a disease on a person through time, when you don't have a treatment to offer. So it means following up a patient from birth until aging and trying to understand how the disease will manifest in different ages. And this is essential for everything. It's essential to understand how the disease will progress. And we know that for most of rare disease, you don't have two patients that will have the same progression. So it's important that you gather the information from a lot of different people from around the world, if you talk about rare disease, because it's important to go global and gather the more information we can, and just follow those people and trying to understand how the disease is progressing or not. And this is essential to understand when the treatments will be useful, but also if we have a treatment, trying to understand what is the difference that is the treatment is making. Because if you don't know how the disease will progress, we are not sure if the treatment is doing anything, because we need to have that kind of information to have a comparison. So the natural history of a disease is essential for research and for future treatments that we might not have nowadays, but maybe in the future we'll have it. And it's a topic that has been quite explored through the years. It all started maybe in the beginning of the 20th century, that people start to see some rare disease and they try to collect data. Initially, it was mostly related with inheritance, because you were trying to still figure out how inheritance will work. And sometimes it was curious if you read these very old papers, they were studying some animals too that also have the same disease, and trying to see, you know, in the animal model, huh, because you probably animals that will have a shorter life than humans, how the disease will progress in those animals. So they were trying to find data everywhere. But then we start to have, in this maybe the 50s and 60s, other initiatives more focused in humans. And they start to just see these patients through the years and see how the disease will progress. I remember when I was at the Johns Hopkins Institute of Medicine in the medical genetics department. I will go through the hallway and they have this very old, furniture that has the name of certain disease. And I was like, wow, this must be the records of the, this natural history record. And they have been here from since the 50s and 60s. So they have been collecting data from patients for many decades. So that's one, I believe, was one of the most, precious hallway I've ever been in my career, because the data there is quite relevant. It was still in on paper probably, because you have to digitalize in the future, but the information there was so important because it will allow us to understand how this of these multiple people were developed their disease. And in that hallway, the focus was mostly Down syndrome and also some skeletal dysplasias. So we have these ideas since the 50s and 60s how the disease is progressing in those people. So that was a very important and a precious resource that is essential to open the way for future treatments. And also, I believe around the early 2000s, we even start to have a team at the National Institute of Health, the NIH in the United States, that was responsible to support people who want to keep these records and registries to expand the number of disease that we will be collecting data and maybe collecting in a way that would be better than this paper on the hallway and shelves. So something more, more modern that will allow a better access to different researchers to that data. So it's a very relevant topic that people have been working through many years. And at the same time, it's one of those things that I don't see many people talking about it nowadays. And actually, I'm quite concerned about it, because nowadays we are trying to invest pour our money in other type of research. We want to have something more translational, something that will put a product in the market, and that's super important. But at the same time, we still need to keep some money on these type of projects of maybe not paying all the possible naturalist projects, but maybe trying to support teams that will support people who want to perform this type of studies. And the people probably who will be more and more involved in collecting this data probably will be the patients, because nobody knows better a disease than the patients, and they might build the natural history studies that are more adjusted to their needs. So that's the future I envision. But at the same time, we are at a time that we really need to, increase the awareness of the relevance of these studies, because sometimes I feel the patients are not aware how important it is to have these records of the history of the disease, to open the way for future treatments.
And it sounds like a process that, as you explained, takes this number of years until complete. There is so much data to be gathered, and the patients are and their families and carers are actually the people that are living with that and seeing live that information developing day after day after day.
And also, some pharmaceutical companies too are also interested in these kind of studies. One classical example was Gaucher disease. Is a disease that there is a specific treatment. So the pharma company that was supporting that treatment was also supporting the natural history studies, because they want to see how the treatment was changing the disease. So they were supporting the collection of that data. And that was very, very important, because you cannot make these kind of studies without professionals and money. So that was a very important alliance to increase the knowledge in this very specific rare disease, the Gaucher disease.
And that's where patient and patient associations and the industry and the ecosystem can really work together to gather the information and treat it professionally, isn't it? So it sounds like it is a true case where patient can be at the center of the strategy, and but everyone working together will ultimately achieve more than if everyone works individually.
Yeah, it's again, you cannot have silos of data in rare disease because you have so few patients sometimes for a disease that to build something strong in terms, even methodologically, in terms of statistics, you really need to, collaborate and integrate all the people and, be very proactive of including patients in different countries and different institutions so you have data that is solid enough to make a conclusion about the efficiency of a treatment.
And Celia, we are talking about data. And these days, it's impossible not to have a conversation without talking about AI. So, how can data science and AI actually help us not only discovering new genes and understand disease more deeply, but also to speed up the research for new treatments?
So in the genetics field, AI is it's not something that new because it always have been part of a lot of the analysis we have been performing. But it was maybe AI that was less developed as the one we have nowadays, because since we have the explosion of LLM, suddenly everybody is more interested in AI. But for many years, AI was essential to help us go through all the genetic information that we were having and trying to filter what was relevant or not. Because looking at genetic information is quite complex. We have we don't even know how many genes we actually have. We believe we have maybe around 20,000 genes that will originate a protein, maybe even more that will originate something a non-coding genes, and then that means we have around 45 maybe around 45,000 genes or even more. We are still not sure. And of these, only around 5,000 we believe are associated with disease at this precise moment, but maybe more are, but we don't know. So we really need AI in to help us deal with this enormous amount of information related with genetics and with genes, trying to understand what, I don't know, the other maybe 80% of the genes that we might know what they do exactly. So AI will be essential to guide us through this information. And sometimes I have to explain to my patients how hard it is to study genes. And sometimes I say that when we have to look for a genetic alteration, it's like I tell them we have one letter in a book that it has a small typo, a mistake, but we don't know exactly what is the book. What is the shelf where the book is? We don't even know where is the library that has that precise book. So we know in this whole city, there is a library, there is a shelf, there is a book, there is a letter that is different, but we don't know where it is. And imagine that you have to go and look for it, but all the books in the city are written in a different language. So it's very complex to find genetic alterations. And so AI will be essential to, filter and help us guide us through all this information and maybe help us trying to make connections between specific disease and the genes that we still don't know what they do or if they do cause a disease. So AI will be essential at that stage of, get to know our genetic information. And even nowadays, we have all these people trying to study what we call the unknown genome, where we have all these genes that we don't know what they do. Some people even call them the genes of uncertain significance. And so it will be important to have something more efficient than our human brain to go through all this information. But if we go out of this maybe very basic science topic, and if you talk about patient data, AI will also be quite important in the future to help us trying to maybe find people with rare disease. There are multiple projects of using the data in the medical records, trying to convert what is written, we call the natural language, in something that is we can, make it more standardized in terms of terms, trying to, because you might use two different words for the same term. So we have AI going through that, trying to make a uniform concept and trying to find people with rare disease. There are some small projects that try to do that, and that would be a way to trying to understand how many people actually have a rare disease, and maybe if they go to their family physicians, it will just, open a, a red flag tab and say, hey, these people have something here that is unusual, so maybe we should consider this rare disease. So maybe even for that, AI could help us, trying to identify red flags in the records. So we are not depending on the knowledge of the physician. We can use the knowledge, or at least the ability of the AI to filter through very dense information, trying to find red flags and identify people with rare disease. But the possibilities are so many that we are all looking forward to see how things will, change in the next decade.
And even though AI is not new, but the amount of data that we've been collecting over the years and how the AI tools are now being developed, it's going to accelerate the entire conversation quite a lot. And you mentioned knowledge there. I really wanted to pick up on that because I would like to link that with what we discussed just about literacy in the different countries. Because as we have more data being generated and with these tools that can actually act as a filter, we are not saying they are going to replace human beings, but they are complementing those analyses. That, and again, bringing up the concept of knowledge, that will be a big help on education as well, in genetics education. Would you agree? I mean, does these tools will actually play a role in educating professionals and society?
I hope so. That's a potential. Well, that would be a very useful use of this all AI wave, trying to generate knowledge in this rare disease, and or at least guide us to the appropriate sources. And this is, for me, something that is already we already been using our daily basis. For instance, we already have a LLM that is directed or targeted to physicians called Open Evidence. It's quite big now, and it helps us, when you even when you have a rare disease, if you ask the right questions, you might have it will guide you to the right sources and help you understand a few rare disease quite fast, because timing is also something important. AI can also help us with that, because the amount of science and information being generated nowadays is it's enormous. Like every time I open my working social media, there is a new disease, a new gene, a new something, and it's impossible to be updated with all these these new knowledge being generated. So AI will be crucial for us to guide us through all that information. But at the end, one thing that I don't know how AI will deal with is guaranteeing that you have the basic knowledge about these topics. And actually, one of my major concerns in literacy is actually how to communicate with different audiences, because maybe we also need to get our AI ready to communicate with different audiences. Of course, if you write it on the prompt, you will be ready for that. But sometimes I feel it's something that we need to be more conscious about. What kind of information we are generating and how to make it more accessible to different audiences. Maybe AI will also include some data visualization is a topic I really like, how to make data something visual that maybe will be easier for a lay audience to understand. So maybe AI will help us go through all that. But I don't know if first we still have to generate the knowledge on that. I mean, we still have a gap in the access to technology. So we have part of our Portuguese population who might use the internet, but maybe if not for looking for knowledge, maybe for, checking the soccer results, trying to, watch some videos of cats on, I don't know, that kind of stuff. And those people are not having access to scientific information, so we are not recording if they are understanding stuff or not. So maybe we need to do some research on that so we can feed the machine of AI, because the AI, it doesn't generate something new. It uses what we are feeding it. So maybe we need to, feed the algorithm with some knowledge about how different audiences would understand this kind of information, trying to, force that on the system. So maybe in the future we can really have a more inclusive AI that will promote literacy of all the population and not just the population that is already using it and who already has, some basic literacy to be able to understand some of the concepts.
And that makes me think of the patient organizations, for example, where on one hand, those tools can maybe help them to become these education hubs. On the other hand, they might not have the enough digital literacy to make use of those tools.
Exactly, yeah.
So in my question was the patient associations are already helping families and supporting these families in many different ways. How can they also become these key hubs? And since we are talking about genetics, the key hubs for genetics education in their own communities?
Well, it's a very important topic, and actually we were discussing that a few weeks ago at this event about the European reference networks, because we want to understand how can we as a scientific or medical community collaborate more with patient associations so we create this more dynamic interaction that promotes that patients are an active element in the training and promoting literacy of the communities. And I heard about some very interesting projects that some of them are even promoting literacy among children, trying that children understand more of these genetic concepts. And right now, most of these are have been pro been promoted by these institutions at the European level. But the vision of this institution is for the future to have the patient association being more active and more engaged in promoting their own activities of promoting literacy, because when you're talking about these institutions at a European level, they are very central, and it's quite important that we have some local hubs that will adjust for the local necessities and the local population that will need that kind of literacy. So I believe that. Well, the idea or the vision for the future is to train a few patients, associations, a few people to go back to their community and try to promote that type of literacy. And we have some very good examples in Portugal. Our RD Portugal, our local national rare disease patient association, they have some initiatives also for children that if a children with a rare disease is having some issues in the school with the teachers and colleagues understanding the difference of that person with a rare disease, they have this project that promotes literacy in the classroom where someone from the association, the patient associations, promotes a specific curriculum, a specific content that will promote that children are more aware of rare disease. And this is the type of projects that makes a big difference for patients. So I believe the way to go is to try to create something more dynamic between the patient associations and some institutions that can provide the appropriate training, and then ask the patient associations to promote locally events that they fit better their local population. And of course, I'm a health professional, so we are looking forward to collaborate to these type of projects and to promote this dynamic collaboration between the healthcare professionals, the international associations, and also the local patient associations.
And just going back to the analogy that you did with the library, the shelves, the books and the letters, by having this reliable information, the patients will better understand these concepts, and that maybe support this urgency in getting the treatment that so often we hear about. So many associations and many patients always talk about finding a cure. But what I'm hearing throughout this conversation is, yes, a cure is important, a treatment is important, making better life quality is important, but it's also very important to collect good data that can then support everything else. Would you agree, Celia?
Yeah, for sure. And even before that, even having patients having a diagnosis is still a challenge. I believe more than half of the patients who come to my appointment in medical genetics, more than half, they will leave without a genetic diagnosis. And again, it's related with also the fact that we still don't know what most of our genes do. So that's a big topic. And sometimes trying to explain, the analogy of the library and the letters and all that, it's also important so patients understand why sometimes you don't get a treatment or why sometimes you don't have a diagnosis, because this is quite new for most of the population. Most of the population expect that you do the test and it will give you a diagnosis, and that's very far from the reality of most people. We still have so many things to get to know, and then even if you have a diagnosis, we are still fighting it for it to be fast, because sometimes people, it takes them still many years until they get to the right prof to the professional who is more ready to get a diagnosis or to guide the patients to a diagnosis. So that's also a fight. And then even if you have a diagnosis, okay, now you want to talk about a cure or what is the best therapy for a specific. And when I'm talking about therapy, I'm not talking about medical therapy. Sometimes I'm talking about physical therapy. I'm talking about speech therapy. And people ask, okay, now you know the gene, what is the best treatment? And I'm like, I still don't know. I don't. Sometimes I don't. I can't check the other five patients that I have in the publications with the same gene altered, and I can compare with those. But that's it. I don't have other patients in the world to compare. Maybe there are hundreds, but they are not published. The information, it's kept in, in private records. So we don't have access to that information to answer what you are asking in my appointment. So should I invest more in physical therapy or speech therapy? How are the other patients at the age of 5, 10, 15, and 20? I'm like, the information is out there, but I don't have access to it. I just have access to, sometimes a simple paper with five patients, and that's it. So collecting that data, it's important, not even for a cure, but sometimes just to make a story to the families of how the disease will, or what are the possibilities of the disease will progress.
And that resonates so much with my own experience. When I got my son's diagnosed for an ultra rare disease, everything I had at the time were two scientific papers with just a couple of people described in each one of them. So not a lot of information, but the urgency was there. And finally, today we have a lot more data collected, and that is bringing real value, even though it spans over so many years, but it's bringing real value into the quality of life. And also something that I always find interesting, and Sally, I believe you were also touching a little bit upon it, is what is a cure? And I've heard this in a couple of conferences in the past, and then I've tried to ask that question myself to others, and it's interesting that the answer is always not the same. So it can be medicines, it can be a treatment, but it can be just a device or a physiotherapy that brings you 5% more breathing capacity, and because of that, the patient has better living quality. So it's a very interesting question. But that also, everything we've been discussing here, I feel always comes back to education and literacy. So if you could design this ideal plan to improve genetics literacy across Europe, what would be the first steps?
It's I will just jump on the usual stuff, because when you're talking about education, most of the times we go back to schools, and that's quite common, but that's how that's where I'll start it in. And at this moment, I'm actually designing the medical genetics curriculum of a new medical school in Universidade de Aveiro. So I'm going through that thought quite often on my on a daily basis of what is the best training we can give to health professionals so we guarantee that they are ready to deal with patients with rare disease and patients with genetic disorders, and that they do them efficiently, and that they are ready to the change that is coming. Because it's really hard to educate people when you don't know how medicine will be in 10 years. You just need to, you know, give some basic tools for them to be ready for the future. So, but that's the basic, trying to introduce some of these concepts in schools, in health professional schools, and just that in a way that it's useful for patients. Why am I saying that? Because when I had genetics in back in school, back in the early 2000s, it was very useless. Because I was learning about all these machines and all these lab techniques that we don't use anymore. And that was a waste of time. I was not learning about the patients. So the way I was learning genetics was very methods based and not patient-centered. And that's when you're talking about the future of education of genetics, we should put the patient at the center, trying to not talk about only the techniques, but also the patient odyssey and the patient circuit going through different professionals. So that's my vision of education, is education for health professionals that is more focused on the patient experience, and that it focus on a few competencies and not only on knowledge. So the students will be ready for the future that we don't know exactly how it will be, but if, and we need also try to work on the lay audience education, and that's the tougher, because for if you had this conversation maybe 10 or 20 years ago, I will talk about maybe make a collaboration with the media, you know, with journalists, and but that's a challenge nowadays because we have less and less professionals dedicated to communication. All the journalists are going through a crisis in their profession. We have less and less professionals who are dedicated to health and science. Even in Portugal, they are few and fewer as times goes by. So in the past, I will try to promote that we educate these communicators so they can communicate with a broader audience these topics. But nowadays it's more challenging because we have AI generating the texts for communication, and also our way of communicating with people is more driven by influencers and not professionals. So at this moment, I don't know how can we promote education of a more general audience, because it's not something that is as professional as it was in the previous decades. So that will be a challenge, but at the same time, maybe it will create some opportunities for the patient associations to be themselves to promote that kind of education. And for instance, I follow on social media this mother who has a son with a neurodegenerative rare disease. The Instagram is called Love Logan, and it's super rich in stories and trying to explain what it means to have a child with a rare disease. So at the same time, it can be an opportunity to have some people give a more personal experience and trying to educate people about this rare disease in a more human and personal way. But again, that's a good example. I don't know if we'll have, you know, other bad examples coming, but let us see.
Yeah, no, indeed, communication is also at the center, and these new generations hopefully will learn to communicate these difficult, complex topics in a simple way without losing the scientific sides of it. Sally, thank you very much for joining us today on this conversation. I've just learned a lot. And today we explored the fundamentals of genetics, why understanding them matters, how data and AI are reshaping research, and above all, the crucial role that education plays across the entire ecosystem. One thing to me got clear: when patients, professionals, and communities understand the genetics, everything moves faster. As it was rightly pointed, not just for the treatment and innovation, but also since the very beginning of the diagnosis. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for being part of a community that believes knowledge empowers and transforms. If you found today's episode helpful, share it, follow the podcast, and help us bring more awareness and clarity to the rare disease world. Until next time, thank you very much. Take care, stay curious, and keep learning.